Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie is always joined by John. John, I don't remember how to do this.
It's been a while. Guys, we appreciate you sticking around and tuning in. Happy New Year. Happy January 2026.
Yeah, first full Tuesday episode of the new year. We had a full episode for Patreon where we talked about the John Paul Miller case and talked with Beth Braden from Luna Shark, who has the inside track on a lot of what has happened and it is happening there. Great conversation. Beth is the best. So if you have an opportunity to support us on Patreon, that in and of itself is probably worth it. So we appreciate you for all of last year. It was a great year for our show. We're excited about this year and some things to come. And John, I'm pumped. I don't know. You know, I don't like the new year thing. Kind of excited about rejuvenated, if you will, about podcast.
I hope so, man. We have a great way to start the new year. We have a new Patreon member in Amanda. So Amanda, thank you so much for joining Patreon. You joined right at the beginning of 2026, and we appreciate it. Amanda came in at the $3 a month level. So if you are like Amanda and want to listen to our like exclusive episodes, then you can join for as little as $3 a month. Get instant access to all of our backlogged episodes, and you get early ad-free content when available as well.
Like I mentioned earlier, we've taken some time off. We got ahead for the holidays. I said I forgot how to do this. You know what I did do is watch a lot of true crime documentaries.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to be honest, some of them were home runs and fantastic, and I can't wait to talk about some of those cases. Some of them we got coming up. Including the yogurt shop murders. That was a good show as well. Some that did not hit home runs, but this was a good one. And this I think is a famous case with aside from that documentary. So it was already on our list and I'm excited to dive into it.
Well, why don't you get the ball rolling, man?
Yeah. Going back 35-ish years, December 6th, 1991.
That's not 35 years. Come on now.
That's 15 years ago, max.
Right? Golly, time is flying.
Four girls were working and hanging out at the I Can't Believe It's yogurt shop in Austin.
That makes me think of butter. I can't believe it's not butter.
That's the only time I've ever heard that. But yeah, it's a catchy title. It was a popular shop and two of the girls have been working there. Two were just visiting. But at this point, they were closing up. Eliza Hope Thomas was born May 16th of 1974 in Austin. Her parents were Maria and James Thomas. She was an only child, and her family was really close-knit, tight, and loving. She was a kind and independent individual who was also very curious. And obviously, she had a lot of friends. She was well-liked by both classmates and teachers. At the time this happened, she was a senior at Lanier High School, and she balanced academics with extracurricular activities and, of course, her after-school job at I Can't Believe It's Yogurt. She played clarinet in the school band and sang in the school choir. Friends remember that she would be shy when she first got to know you, but once you did, she was very loyal and also pretty funny when you got to know her. They said Eliza had a love for animals, especially cats. She was known for being very artistic, had a gentle heart, and at her job at the yogurt shop, she often took closing shifts to help others and to earn some extra money. There's a lot to do when you close up any business, and she liked to be there. Not only did she get extra money, but she got to hang out with people.
I remember working closing shifts at a grocery store when I was a kid, and you know, the store would close at 9, but it would be 10 or 10:30 before we'd get out of there. So
much to do.
Hour and a half.
So much to clean up, put up. You're trying to get ready to go early in the next morning. And that's certainly what was happening here. And this was, I don't know, I can't think of yogurt not being messy.
So. Well, yeah. And the closing time is fun because the customers are gone and usually the bosses are gone. So you have a lot to do, but you can usually let your hair down and be a little funny
turn up
and
the
zany
music
while you're doing it.
Yeah.
So that night, Eliza was working the closing shift with Jennifer Ann Harbison. So a little bit about Jennifer. She was born on May 9, 1974. Her parents' names were Mike and Barbara. She was originally raised in Texarkana, but moved to Austin with her mother and her younger sister when her parents, Mike and Barbara, split up. Jennifer was an opinionated and outgoing teenager, and she was in her senior year at Lanier High School. She was the president of the school's Future Farmers of America chapter. She competed on her track team, and she was a member of the drill team. So just like our kids, she was busy. She was always right into something, it sounds like. Her teachers remembered her for always having corny jokes. Let me just tell you, I think I would really like this kid. Like, you tell me a good dad joke, I'm going to like you for a long time.
I have seen you laugh till you cry at horrible dad jokes.
I love it so much. We played this game in our youth group where the kids would have to tell jokes and see if they could get the teachers to laugh. And any kid who did a joke, automatically,
you lost immediately.
But they're great. So one teacher said that she was, quote, more excited about life than any kid I've ever known. Wow. So sounds like she was just a pure joy to be around. Jennifer was working at the yogurt shop. She was trying to help pay for her car. Her dad had bought her a dark blue Chevy S10, which in the 1990s, that was like the car. You know, as a truck, it was a small truck, but everybody who was cool had a Chevy S10. He bought it for her on the condition that she helped pay for it, but she also needed to help drive her little sister around.
Yeah, I like those stipulations. You're right. Everybody had either an S10 or a Ford Ranger.
I was a Ford Ranger guy.
I know you were. That's the
biggest.
What
did you have?
I didn't have an S10. I had a Chevy Cavalier.
Well, that was another go-to.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty common back then. So we mentioned that a requirement of Jennifer getting her car was to help drive her sister around. So, as you may guess, the next girl at the yogurt shop that night was Sarah Harbison, Jennifer's younger sister. Sarah adored and admired her big sister. The two were very close. They had really similar interests. She was also involved in FFA, which John mentioned that that's Future Farmers of America. That was also really big where I grew up. It's an organization that's very popular. It's almost, and it's pretty rigorous when you get to like the officer level type thing. They did competitions at fairs and that kind of thing with animals, showing your knowledge. And we've had a couple kids that we mentor and teach that have done that recently.
My niece was, when she was in high school, the president of her chapter. And I swear it might as well have been a full-time job.
It's a lot.
She was busy all the time.
Yeah. And this is an area where it was huge and important. So of course she was involved there. Sarah was a freshman at Lanier High School, and she was known for being kind, intelligent, and funny. She was particularly interested in animal husbandry, including raising and showing livestock. Sarah's friends would say that she was warm-hearted, spirited, and really mature for her age. And you have multiple kids at your house. I have multiple kids at my house, and their relationship, Sarah and Jennifer's, is one that, I don't know, I'm kind of jealous of. That doesn't necessarily exist in my house right now. I hope it does someday, but to have a close group of siblings with similar interests. And it's obviously Jennifer has been a really good example for Sarah because Sarah's doing really well.
It often happens when kids get older and they're adults, but to have that at home when they're both teenagers would be, yeah, like, I don't know what I would do with myself.
Yeah.
When my kids get along, I look at my wife, I'm like, what's happening? Is someone dying and I don't know it?
Somebody's like, really mad.
So that night, Sarah had her friend Amy Lee Ayers with her at the yogurt shop, and she was waiting for a ride home from Jennifer. So Amy was born January 31st, 1978 in Austin. She was the youngest of the girls. She met Sarah at Burnett Middle School, where Amy was still in the eighth grade. Amy was described as free-spirited and endlessly curious. And like all the other girls, she was an animal lover who participated in the Junior Future Farmers of America. In 1991, she was raising a lamb named Tootie as part of the FFA. And if you're going to have a lamb, I think that Tootie is the best name for
such
one.
A solid name.
She wanted to be a veterinarian someday, and teachers said that she was very funny, kind, and a little bit of a prankster. So again, I think Amy would have been a fun kid to be around as well.
It sounds like all these young ladies were a good time. They were good-hearted. They were good to each other and liked to have a good time. Shortly before midnight that night, and again, they're cleaning up the yogurt shop. That entails mopping the floors, taking out trash, putting away the yogurt left over from that night, getting the machines cleaned out, which sounds horribly messy, but they were in the middle of it. They were playing music. And right after midnight, a patrolman from the Austin Police Department contacted his dispatcher and said that he saw fire coming from the yogurt shop. Now, it was kind of in a strip mall area, so you could see the smoke coming, but when you get there, you can see it's directly over the yogurt shop.
Something you wouldn't expect to see in a frozen yogurt shop. I'm sure there's not like a grill or something like that. So my first thought are like mechanical fire of some kind, an electrical fire of right. some kind.
Yeah, so they called it in and they got firemen on the scene and they got there and there was an actual fire in the back. So they rushed in and they put the fire out. But once they had, they encountered a horrifying sight. After they put the fire out, they then noticed that there were four burned, nude bodies in the yogurt shop, and each had been shot in the head execution style.
This is horrifying. I can't imagine putting out a fire and then seeing this. Like, this is just so disturbing to have to even think about.
I know firefighters have to deal with death and injury, and they're trained to deal with those things. But in this instance, I think they thought they were just showing up to put out an electrical fire and let somebody else deal with repairs or whatever.
Especially that time of night, you think this is something that's just a mechanical issue that caused a fire, and you're going to be in and out. And yeah, it sucks for the owners, but that's the extent of it. Well, that's the furthest from the truth.
Yeah, and as you can probably tell, the victims were 17-year-old Eliza, 17-year-old Jennifer, 15-year-old Sarah, and 13-year-old Amy. Sarah, Eliza, and Jennifer were all gagged and bound with their own underwear. The youngest one, Amy, was found in a separate part of the shop. She was not charred like the other girls, but she had received very early third-degree burns on about 30% of her body. Amy had a sock-like cloth around her neck, and while the other girls only had one bullet wound in their heads, Amy had two.
The police chased down thousands of leads that led absolutely nowhere. Most of the physical evidence that would have been on the scene had been destroyed by the flames or by the water that was used to put out the flames. And I'm not going to put any blame on the firefighters. I mean, they walked into a fire that little did they know they were walking into a murder scene. So, of course, they have to put out the fire. Even if they did know this was a murder scene, they would still have to put out the fire.
Right.
Eventually, investigators closed in on a 16-year-old named Maurice Pierce, who was caught at a nearby mall a few days later with a weapon of the same caliber as the one that was used in the murders. And they brought him in for questioning. After lots and lots of questions, the detectives decided that the information he was giving was just enough to get out of gun charges. So when his stories did not align with the details of the scene, and when ballistics came back inconclusive, police ended up eliminating Pierce as a suspect, and his three friends, who were all 17 or under at the time, were cleared as well. But that was not the end of their story. So in 1999, that was 8 years after the murders, the Yogurt Shop Task Force revisited the case and reviewed the original case files, and then they decided to bring in the four boys, who were now in their 20s, and they wanted to ask them some more questions. So Maurice Pierce, Robert Springsteen, Michael Scott, and Forrest Wilborn were all brought in and interrogated again. Springsteen and Scott eventually confessed and implicated one another in the murders. Pierce and Wilborn did not confess, but were implicated in the others' confessions. All four were ended up being arrested for capital murder in 1999. Again, that was 8 years after the original murders.
Right. And, you know, you stopped short of placing any blame on the firefighters because they had to put the fire out. I do get a little frustrated at this point of the story where you have somebody in custody and you're interviewing them and their story's not lining up, but the evidence is potentially there. The ballistics was inconclusive. I don't love ballistics anyway. I've been pretty vocal about that. But he still fits the mold, right? So why would you eliminate him? I understand you're working through a lot of stuff. I don't see anything here that I think should have eliminated him as a suspect. Maybe put him further down the list to come back to later, but I don't know. Kind of frustrating to me that they had this guy they wanted to arrest in their office. And spoiler alert, things are going to change later. But even with what we've seen here, it seems like they kind of fumbled the investigation a little bit early on. And we're going to take a break. When we get back, we'll talk about what happened after the arrest and who we think actually committed the yogurt shop murders. While all four were arrested for capital murder in 1999, a grand jury decided to indict only three of them. There was not enough evidence, according to that grand jury, to indict Welborn. The charges against Pierce were dropped, and even though there was no physical evidence that tied anybody to the crime, Scott and Springsteen were still put on trial. And remember, those are the two that actually confessed. So the other two, without physical evidence and only having the confessions of Scott and Springsteen, they were set free. These men said that their confessions were under distress. They looked for a way out of a very intense interrogation and claimed they were coerced into confessing, which I think now, in 2026 now, we're more well aware of false confessions. We're more well aware of the way that young minds work. These were teenagers. So could they have possibly confessed under duress and not have been telling the truth? These confessions were the only hard evidence, if you will, presented by the prosecution at trial. Scott was convicted in 2002 and given a sentence of life in prison. Springsteen was also convicted back in 2001, and he was sentenced to death. Now, I will say that the documentary opens with Springsteen, and you kind of start from his point of view of what's happening here, so it's pretty fascinating to start with him before the crime. But in 2005, Governor Rick Perry commuted Springsteen's sentence to life in prison since he was a juvenile at the time the crime was committed. In 2008, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals overturned the men's convictions, saying that there was no opportunity for defense to cross-examine each male's accuser per their Sixth Amendment rights. So, they accused each other, and they both refused to take the stand. So, it's kind of almost a catch-22 situation when you think about it logically or legally here. But, man, if that's all you got, that's a pretty big blow, right? That's an odd place to find yourself in.
Yeah. I mean, it really seems like the only thing they have are each of their confessions. And since they were not going to testify against each other, that's really all they had.
It was. There was supposed to be some DNA testing done, and they were doing this to plan for a retrial since it had been overturned. But the evidence showed that none of it matched Pierce, Scott, Springsteen, or Welborn. Now, that's not to say that they definitely weren't there, but the evidence that they found DNA on very likely mapped back to the killer or killers, and none of it met them. So they were all freed in 2009.
It's hard to say with certainty, even if the DNA they did have would have been certainly from the murderers. I mean, I don't know what these pieces of evidence are. You know what I mean? So this is a public place. So if they just randomly got samples from a chair or something like that, you can't conclusively say that would have been from the murderer anyway. But if this was a situation where someone was raped and there were fluids there that, you know, but with it being a fire and water being used to douse the fire, who knows whose DNA?
And how did they find any DNA anyway? Like, most of it was definitely ruined. So
this reminds me of a case in the city where we live. Like, there was a fire. A firefighter responded and doused a couch that probably had evidence on it, and now it's gone forever. So who's to say that the DNA that was tested was even from the murder? You just don't know.
Well, here's my assumption what happened here. I think the DA had intended to go back to trial, but realized that the case was really weak and was kind of depending on this DNA evidence coming in, because they only had the confessions. This issue with the Sixth Amendment rights were not going to go away. So if they didn't have something else, going back to court was not going to work out. So I think they dropped the charges at this point because they knew they couldn't get a confession just based solely, or couldn't get a conviction based solely on the confessions.
So now, they had been convicted, but because they were 17, they reduced that, you know, after that law went into effect. We talked about that with the Tennessee case years ago. So basically they were convicted, but the court said, we can't prove you're guilty. We also can't prove you're innocent.
Yeah. So they didn't give them compensation for that because they had been in prison for a decade. So, or close to it, at least. That's when they were arrested. It was 1999. They were free in 2009. But the courts didn't give either of them any compensation because they didn't prove they were innocent of the crime, which the burden of proof is on the state for conviction. How does that apply here? It's a very complicated and complex situation that I'm glad I'm not making decisions in, but it's really, really messy, and I'm not sure they got all of it right.
Yeah, we'll talk more at the end of this about whether or not they should have been released, because they were convicted and they were given the death penalty. It was later reduced to life in prison, but here they're freed. So we'll talk more about that. Let's kind of go on from there on this timeline. So Austin police said that over the years, they have received over 50 false confessions. One of those was from a convicted serial killer who was being put to death and on his deathbed confessed to this. That's certainly interesting. And, you know, I guess that should be explored in some way. So they do have DNA from the scene, but there have been no matches as of 2009. Let's fast forward to December 23rd, almost Christmas time of the following year, 2010. So there was an Austin police officer named Frank Wilson and his partner were conducting a traffic stop on a vehicle that was driven by Pierce in the northern part of the city. Pierce initially fled on foot, but Wilson caught up with him. So when Wilson caught Pierce, they had a struggle, and then Pierce grabbed a knife from his belt and stabbed the police officer, Frank Wilson, in the neck. Wilson was able to grab his gun, take it out, and shoot Pierce. Thankfully, Officer Wilson did survive his injuries. However, Pierce did not.
So again, Pierce was one of the individuals originally arrested for the murder, was not convicted of the yogurt shop murders. Now let's fast forward to August 3rd of 2022. President Biden signed into law the Homicide Victims Families Rights Act of 2021, which was inspired by this case, by the yogurt shop murders. The law helps ensure that federal law enforcement reviews cold case files and applies emerging technology and investigative standards on these older cases.
Dude, I love this. And I often get political and give some crap, but this is awesome. This is really, really good. And there's some cases around here that I really feel are only going to be solved when federal investigators get involved.
And, you know, the way things are advancing just so quickly, technology and other testing for DNA and other pieces of evidence is so different than it was 5 years ago at this point, let alone 30 years ago. Like, there's so much more we can get from things, so many crimes that we can solve. And, you know, of course, you want to serve justice and help the families, but a lot of these can still prevent other people from being hurt.
Absolutely. So, 10 out of 10, take my tax money to do this with.
Absolutely. Love this. That same year, Detective Daniel Jackson was assigned to the yogurt shop murder case as somebody who would take a new look at it. Jackson met with several subject matter experts on DNA and genealogy while he put together a list of items from the scene that were identified for retesting. In June of 2025, seems like just last year, John, Jackson determined that there was a 380 cartridge, so that's from a 380 caliber .38 pistol, that was found in a drain at the scene had not been submitted into the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network.
That is a very common pistol. It's very small, concealable. It's a bigger cartridge than a 22, but very, very common for a carried weapon.
Yeah, we've talked about you and I having concealed carry permits, and a 380 is what I carry when I do carry a weapon. It is very small, kind of a smaller version of a 9mm, if you will. But so this database is called NIBIN. Great name. That's a National Integrated Ballistic Information Network again. So the software had been greatly improved since the last time they had taken a look at this case through that software. In August of 2025, he requested a Y-STR search from all labs in the U.S. that keep Y-STR profiles. And if you're wondering what the Y-STR is, that's a DNA profile extracted from the Y chromosome specifically, so just dudes. One lab in South Carolina had a profile that seemed to match one of the samples from the yogurt shop murders. That profile belonged to a man that was known to law enforcement and had been convicted of multiple murders and rapes. And his name was Robert Eugene Brashears.
Brashears' DNA was connected to a sexual assault and murder in Greenville, South Carolina. So to confirm, Austin police retested the STR, the YSTR DNA from under Amy's fingernails. And again, it was a direct match to Brashears' profile. Detective Jackson said, quote, "Amy's final moments on Earth were to solve this case. It's because she fought back," end quote. Before the yogurt shop murders, Brashears had served time in prison for shooting a woman, and he was granted parole in 1989. Detective Jackson discovered that just 2 days after the yogurt shop murders, he was stopped by Border Patrol between El Paso, Texas, and La Cruces, Mexico. He was driving a stolen car out of Georgia and was carrying a 380 pistol. So his DNA has also linked him to violent crimes in and around the U.S., including the 1990 strangulation of a South Carolina woman, a 1997 rape of a 14-year-old girl in Tennessee, and the 1998 murders of a mother and daughter in Missouri. He never stood trial for any of these crimes. That's because in 1999, Brashears was in a police standoff when he shot and killed himself by shooting himself in the head. The gun that he used to commit suicide had the same serial number as the gun that he had in the car the couple of days after the yogurt shop murders. Then, ballistic tests showed the gun produced patterns consistent with the bullet casings that were found in the drain at the crime scene.
So to be clear, we had this was under Amy's fingernails. Amy, the 13-year-old, she was found away from everybody else. Now, if you watch the documentary or do any research on your own, you'll see diagrams of where people were. And it really seems like the three older girls were in the same area, kind of contained. And maybe that Amy was running away when she was shot and then fought back. And she had this DNA under her fingernails and it matched Brashears directly. So, of course, DNA is like, well, it basically excludes everybody else on Earth is the way that that would work. So this is a great start and so much more evidence than they ever had against the four guys they arrested first. And then they start to use other pieces. So the weapon he was carrying, the round that it shot out at the scene that was found in the drain, all seems to match. Days after the murders, funeral services were held for each of the girls at St. Louis Catholic Church. There were nearly 1,000 people who gathered inside and outside to pay their respects to the girls. Friends and loved ones continued to care for their animals that they loved so much from FFA. They later showed them off at the Travis County Livestock Show. Eliza's remaining little sister, Sonora, took care of her sister's prized hog and earned the title of champion pig at the show. Again, this may seem kind of silly. You're picturing Charlotte's Web here. This was very important to these young girls. Amy's friend Melissa cared for her pig, and Sarah's friend Christy cared for her lamb. Jennifer's friend Miranda cared for her lamb. When the time came for Eliza and Jennifer's graduation from high school, their class honored them at the commencement ceremony by placing caps, gowns, and flowers in the seats that would have been theirs.
Brother, that is absolutely heartbreaking. Every kid deserves to finish high school. As a parent, man, I can't imagine seeing that. Even if I'm not the parent of that child, it would still be so hard to see. But, man, my heart just breaks for all of these girls' families, their parents. It's unimaginable.
And this was a tight-knit community. Yes, it was absolutely horrific for the parents to see and live through, but it didn't stop there. This was something that impacted everybody in the area, and everybody lived through for such a long time without any answers. So, yeah, it was obviously around 1,000 people came to see the girls, and I bet there were many more that were hurting because of this.
The town was relieved to finally have answers. Even though it took almost 3 decades, this was finally the answer that everyone was looking for. Austin Police Chief Lisa Davis said, quote, "After 34 years, the Austin police have made a significant breakthrough in one of the most devastating cases in our city's history. This unthinkable crime has weighed heavily on the hearts of our community and families of the victims and our detectives who have tirelessly pursued justice," end quote. The mom of Jennifer and Sarah would go on to say, quote, "I'm full of gratitude. It has been so long, and all we ever wanted was the truth. We never wanted anyone to go to jail or to be charged with anything that they did not do. Vengeance was never it. It was always the truth," end quote. Austin Mayor Kirk Watson said, "Austin lost its innocence the night those young girls became victims. Today was a long time coming," end quote. So the solving of this case was definitely, if there is any relief, it was that, just because the truth was finally known. And there were people who were wrongly accused of this crime, who spent time in prison for this crime. So finally having the truth meant a lot to a lot of people. Michael Scott, one of the people who was convicted, said, "This case stole decades of my life, but the truth has finally come to light." So that is, I don't know if there was any grace that Michael could have given. I think that is just about it. Now, this case has been officially solved. Scott and Springsteen are seeking restitution, up to $80,000 for each year that they were imprisoned. Their lawyers remain hopeful that this will happen. Today, the yogurt shop is no longer in the same place, but a plaque remains there that honors the memory of Eliza, Jennifer, Sarah, and Amy. This is a very intriguing case. There's so many things going on, but ultimately you have 4 girls taken before their time in a most horrific way. It did take almost 3 to 4 decades to solve it, but finally it was solved. But my heart does go out, you know, not only to the victims' families, but there were teenage boys who were imprisoned for up to, what was it, almost 10 years?
Yeah.
Who did absolutely nothing wrong. And that's heartbreaking as well.
And here's the thing. They did nothing wrong. And the prosecution only had their confessions and still moved forward. Sometimes the desire to close a case supersedes the desire to solve the case. And I think that's part of what happened here.
Over the years, man, we've talked so many times about people who have given confessions, and you spend potentially hours in interrogations, and they probably didn't have attorneys.
Yeah.
You know,
and all these guys were 17 and under. Their frontal lobes are still very malleable.
I would almost guarantee I've ever said. That was, I'm really proud of you.
Thanks, buddy.
I bet that, you know, as a 41-year-old man, if you put me in a room with an officer for 48 hours and didn't give me an attorney or food to eat, I may confess just out of pure exhaustion. And you're looking for a way out of the room, and sometimes confessing is your only way out.
Yeah.
So, and they're telling you, they can tell you lies. Like, we have enough evidence to get the death penalty for you. So just confess and we'll make it not your death, you know?
Right.
So it almost behooves you to confess even when you know you did nothing wrong. Like, we've spent hours talking about this over the years, and it's still fascinating to me that someone would confess to something they did not do.
Yeah, and it's horrific. Robert Springsteen, like I said, the documentary opens on him, and he's preparing to go on a TV show after he's released from death row, which creates some interesting conversations with people that or in the footage, but man, it's tough. And you know, the families, I'm sure they wanted closure. They wanted to know what happened. They probably were all in on seeing the boys convicted because they were convinced that those boys had been the ones to do it. So it's not an easy spot for anybody at all to be in. These families suffered way more than anybody should have to. I'm glad that they finally got this justice. And if nothing else, it just goes to show the capabilities of what we have now and why that act from President Biden could potentially see a lot more justice get served.
I try to put myself in the shoes of others and thinking about their dads, man. Like if I thought that there was a chance those boys murdered my daughter and her friends, I would absolutely want the quickest, swiftest justice and by all means the death penalty. But man, knowing that 10 years later they were going to be let go and then 3 decades later the right information would be found, like, my heart breaks for that guy, those dads too, man. Like,
sure.
I would want to murder those kids. And then knowing that they spent 10 years in prison for something they didn't do, like, that rips my heart out all over again.
So. And it's not just those 10 years. Like, you can't wash off being convicted of murder. So I hope absolutely. They do get some restitution. I think that's absolutely owed. So hopeful that that kind of completes the cycle of providing answers and justice as it's available to those that are involved. And I think with the publicity that this got with the documentary and when the news broke about the arrest, hopefully it's momentum going in the right direction to solve a lot of the cases that we've left our heads from this table scratching our heads over.
Yeah, it gives me so much hope knowing that there are technologies available now and hopefully a lot more victims will have justice because of it.
We really appreciate you guys. Would love to hear your opinion on this. Obviously, I think everybody is happy that it was solved. And I mean, there's always the question, I guess, if you want to dig into it, of was he alone? Because they didn't get to interview him about this. But we do know at least one person that was involved and would love to hear your thoughts on what this could mean for other cases and your takes on the information we shared here today. You can leave that in a 5-star review. We get a lot of recommendations from those reviews that come in for new cases to cover. You can leave it there. You can also leave it on social media. Those are great ways to contact us. We check it regularly. It's legitimately us, and we respond pretty quickly and would love to interact with you guys there.
Yeah, we also get case recommendations from our Patreon members. So if you haven't already, go join that. $3 a month bonus episode. As Jamie mentioned before, we interviewed Beth Braden over the John Paul Miller indictments that came out recently. So go check that one out for January 2026 Patreon.
Guys, we really appreciate you. We're excited for the year to come and look forward to more stories.
And until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.